It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff and Stacy are off this week, but good news, Matthew Ingram and Mike Elgin are here, and we have a lot to talk about, including that Burger King commercial written with artificial intelligence. We've got an Olive Garden commercial we'll act out written with artificial intelligence, but might even show some real intelligence. It's all next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 476, recorded Wednesday, October 3rd, 2018. Warm and defeated. This Week in Google is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twig. And by Capterra. Find software solutions for your business needs. Capterra is a free website with over 600 categories of business software. And now visit Capterra.com/twig to get your free copy of the Big Book of Free Software. And by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on WordPress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month and get 15% off any new plan at WordPress.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. This week, everybody's out. Stacey Higginbotham is out. She's doing something. She's in Dallas or something. And then Jeff Jarvis, is he still in Milan or he's traveling?
I believe he's in London.
He's in London. The good news is we've replaced them with amazing simulations. Matthew Ingram is here from the Columbia Review of Journalism. He's their chief digital writer, CJR.org. Hi, Matthew.
Hey.
Great to see you. He's a nice Canadian fella, so be gentle. And Mike Elgin is here. He has yet to leave, but he's about to leave for Italy, so he's still in the Bay Area. Hi, Mike.
I'll be playing Stacy today. My oven is smarter than my dog.
Mike is at digital. I always get this wrong.
So gastronomad.net.
Gastronomad. I always want to say digital. I don't know why. Gastronomad.net.
And Elgin.com.
And Elgin.com for Mike's list. Yeah. I brought Matthew on because of this article. Explain yourself in the Columbia Journalism. Is the podcast bubble bursting? It was a bubble, actually, wasn't it? I admire you, Matthew, because a lot of mainstream media coverage of podcasting for the last couple of years acted like it was this brand new thing. It was just so hot. And that's part of the reason why the bubble burst, right? Because a lot of people jumped on a bandwagon. You point out that Panoply, which was set up by Slate and really was a well-known network, recently laid off most of its staff. They're not going to create any new shows, just distribute other people's shows. And BuzzFeed laid off the staff at its podcasting unit.
Yeah, it's interesting. BuzzFeed in particular, they said they're going to more like the model they use for TV. So they're still going to do podcasts, but they're going to mostly use freelancers. So obviously I think they wanted to be a bit more flexible, not to get out of podcasting completely. Panoply clearly just decided the money's in kind of selling picks and shovels, not making the actual content.
That's a play on the old line that the only people that made money during the gold rush in San Francisco was Levi's, because they made the jeans for the gold miners.
But I do think, you know, a lot of companies were, let's face it, desperate for new sources of revenue. Advertising's declining. Podcasts like Serial came along, got a lot of attention. A lot of companies thought, great, you know, it's, you just stick a mic in front of a couple of guys and boom, you've got a podcast.
It's just that easy.
And as you know, it takes a lot more work than that. It takes a lot more resources. It takes an investment of time, and you have to really think about what you're doing. And, you know, if it's just a kind of side thing you're doing to try and make some extra revenue, it's probably not going to work very well.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's very similar to what happened with blogging, because really the people who jumped on the bandwagon didn't really get what it was and didn't understand it. They overspent. just like in podcasting. And for example, my favorite definition of a blog comes from Dave Weiner, who said that a blog is the unedited voice of a single person.
Yes. Well, that's
all it
nice.
Is.
Yeah.
And so all these publication companies emerged with professional editors and all this kind of stuff, which is very expensive. You need lots of revenue for that sort of thing. And a podcast, to a certain extent, I don't know if it's certainly not the unedited voice necessarily, but it's something that's more authentic than radio or television. It's more real. And the bandwagon jumpers didn't get that. They did these slick, heavily produced, pretty expensive shows, which then had to be paid for by the tiny number of companies that tend to advertise on podcasts. And it's just really, that's a really tough way to go. And they didn't find the pot of gold they were looking for, just like in blogging. And podcasts will be here forever, despite what Matthew Ingram says.
No, he says it too.
And blogging will be here forever. It's not a get rich quick scheme by any stretch of the imagination.
You embed a tweet from Rose Eveleth. I don't know who she is, but she says the BuzzFeed pivot away from podcasts makes sense when you remember that BuzzFeed lives and dies as a business on detailed analytics. Web content has them. Video has them. I'm not sure I'd agree with that. Podcasts still don't. Do you think that that's – I don't think that's actually the problem, but
I think it's maybe one of them, especially if you're a company like BuzzFeed.
Well, but that's my problem with companies like BuzzFeed in general. Yeah. Is they're chasing hits. They're chasing views. Yeah. And that means it's basically demand media. You create content because it's going to generate views. And in my opinion, as a content creator, that's the worst reason to create content.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And things that makes podcasts so successful when they work well is also one of the things that makes them less appealing to companies like BuzzFeed. And that is, it's difficult to sort of browse or snack them in a way. You have to really devote some time to them.
And on our stuff. It's a full meal.
They really require people to invest a certain amount of, attention and time to it. And that pays off when a podcast does the same, when the person who's doing it pays attention to, or is really passionate about their topic. But that makes it less likely to be the kind of thing that a company like BuzzFeed is going to be interested in.
Way that BuzzFeed should do podcasts is they should think of it as a kind of source of crowdsourcing, fan feedback, reader feedback. They should be in a conversation constantly with their readers, and the goal of it should be both to cement the brand in the minds of their biggest fans, and also to improve the quality of their journalism. Because you see what happens on Twit Network. You have all these shows. They're all about tech. And everybody's learning from all the shows all the time. And so there's a lot of well-informed people talking to you simply because it's a network all on the same topic. So there's a lot of learning, a lot of interaction. That chat room never stops. There's a lot of information that comes in through the chat room and other sources of media. And that's the thing that's so great about podcasting is it's the interaction with the audience potentially.
Yeah. What do you, I think the, if we lump all this stuff into new media, so blogs, podcasts, YouTube, it does really still seem very early days. And it seems like we don't really understand a lot of what's going on.
What's really interesting is that audio, is the most mobile medium there is by far. You can be running a marathon and consume audio content. And this is one of the reasons why, yes, it's not snackable, it's not skimmable, but at the same time, people are doing other things. They're driving, they're doing the dishes, stuff like that. And so audio podcasts can rush into field. Now, those video podcasts are great too, but audio podcasts, and this is going to have a great future because when we get into the world of smart glasses and bone conduction glasses where you can just stream audio all the time, the number of opportunities for listening to podcasts will just grow and grow. So it's really a medium that's audio podcasting is a medium that's well suited for what's coming in the future.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
All you need is one earbud in one ear and you can consume audio podcasts.
Well, and I mean, smart assistants, I think there's a huge amount of potential for people to, you know, listen to podcasts over their Google Home or start it on their phone and continue it on their Google Home or their Alexa. And I do think in a way you're right, Leo, it is still very early if you think about it. You know, podcasts haven't been around really that long. And so I think we're still figuring out what makes a good one and how do kind of audiences engage with it. And then what does that generate in terms of, and obviously you're further along than just about everybody in terms of learning those lessons.
I would say it's more than podcasts, more than new media. A relevant quote from Kara Swisher's opinion piece about Kevin Systrom leaving Facebook. She was of the opinion, and it's interesting that this article became an opinion piece in the New York Times. She's of the opinion that Mark Zuckerberg, the Systrom was an annoyance to Mark Zuckerberg, and he was forced out of Facebook when instead he should have become the next CEO of Facebook because his depth of knowledge and his understanding, he was a perfect CEO, et cetera, et cetera. But at the very end, she quotes Systrom, the creator of Instagram, saying something that I think could apply to what we were just talking about. Social media is in a pre-Newtonian moment.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of social media, let's say the internet is in a pre-Newtonian moment where we all understand that it works, but not how it works. Just as before Newton, we knew gravity existed. We just didn't know how it worked. There are certain rules that govern it, and we have to make it our priority to understand the rules or we cannot control it. I'm not sure I agree with the control it thing. I think that would be a misguided mission to control it. But I think it is useful to understand the rules if you want to make it.
When you said pre-Newtonian, I thought you were talking about the Apple Newton.
Or a fig Newton. But no, Sir Isaac, I think, was the
I remember reading that quote, too, and I think he's right. I think we get so carried away with, you know, how much has changed in the last, whatever, 10, 15 years. But really, it's a fraction of a second, you know, humanity-wise in terms of since the internet, let alone since the web or digital or...
It seems we're so immersed in it. It seems like it's always been here. And we're by the way, we have in studio today 47 16-year-olds from Australia who are on a field trip to the United States. Hello, kids. They grew up with this stuff, right? I mean, it's been their whole lives. Podcasting, from their point of view, has probably been there their whole lives. It's about 14 years old. So since they were two, and certainly the internet has. So it might feel to them as if, oh, man, I mean, I don't even know what life was like before the internet. But for people, an oldster like me, it's pretty, I do remember pre-internet days. And I don't think we understand it very well. I do think we're in a pre-Newtonian moment.
I think that one of the interesting conversations we should be having is instead of saying, oh, my gosh, does podcasting have a future? What's going to happen with podcasting? I think we should all be talking about why, given the existence of podcasting, do we need television and radio? Because the whole model of television and radio is based on artificial scarcity and all these other like barriers that sort of enrich the controllers of those things. Everything should be a podcast. Everything.
I agree. Or YouTube. I'll bet you you guys probably don't watch TV very much. You probably watch a lot of YouTube, though, right? Yeah, they're nodding. I know even with my older kids, my son is 23, YouTube is the source for everything for him. He wanted to learn how to cook. He watched YouTube videos.
Yep. Yeah, my daughter's the same.
Yeah.
Who needs knowledge when you get YouTube?
That does raise another issue, which is it's these part of the reason we like them is just as you were describing, Mike, they're unfiltered, unedited. They're very personal. They're very passionate, but there's no gatekeeper.
And often wrong.
But for that reason, you know, unlike and we have this argument with Jeff all the time because Jeff Jarvis will blow a gasket and say, well, you couldn't trust where are you saying you could trust the New York Times 20 years ago? It's just, it appeared to be trustworthy. There appeared, because there were gatekeepers, there appeared to be some...
There were more filters.
There were more filters. Doesn't mean it wasn't wrong from time to time.
I also think there's, and Jeff and I have talked about this too, there isn't just the occasional wacko who has a YouTube channel peddling conspiracy theories. There's also YouTube, the engine, the algorithmic driven recommendation engine that is feeding those videos to users, to audiences. And that's an element that we haven't had before, one that we don't really understand very well, I don't think.
Yeah. So I would quibble a little bit with Kevin Systrom about the need to control it, but it's true that what we don't understand is how it works. And when you look at something like Twitter, which kind of, like many social sites, descended into a dumpster fire, how do you keep social sites from doing that? We don't really understand very much of that.
I think if you think about Twitter, or even Facebook for that matter, there's literally nothing that has ever existed in history that is like that. So there's nothing that has ever connected that many people in that way. So there is no like metaphor. You can say, oh, well, people didn't trust newspapers, or people didn't trust, you know, TV anchors. Well, they're really not comparable. There's never been a network that connected 2 billion people on a daily basis. There's never been the ability to share your thoughts instantaneously with potentially hundreds of millions of people. And we just don't know how to behave, like how that works. So you post something on Twitter, is that like you publishing it in a newspaper article, or is it like you stapling something to a telephone pole, or is it like you standing in a park or a public square yelling? It's like all of those things.
All of the above, yeah.
And also things that we don't even understand yet.
Well, and there's also this, the truth about Twitter is very solipsistic, that it's a bunch of journalists on Twitter. How many of you young people use Twitter? How many of you? So about, not many. How about Facebook? How many of you are on Facebook? A little more. How about Snapchat? How many of you are on, almost all of you? Instagram? Yeah, that's the most, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the other thing is Twitter gets, I think, a disproportionate amount of attention, especially in the news
agreed.
Media.
Yeah, agreed.
It's not really, it's a small selecting group
tiny
of people.
Proportion. Yeah.
But you know, this is the interesting thing about Twitter is, you know, that's not an inconsequential demographic, all the
True.
Journalists.
True.
And, you know, journalists get enormous amounts of stories and interaction and stuff like that from Twitter. So really, I see Twitter, you know, if I'm going to pick a metaphor that's off of Matthew's list, it's almost like an adjunct to the world of journalism to a certain extent. Right. I mean, you were talking
it's one of your sources.
Right. You were talking on Twitter, making the observation that everybody's like, oh my gosh, you know, President Trump is so fantastic at using Twitter. He uses Twitter to play the media like a fiddle, and
well,
if you look
he does
at actual
it well, right,
but if you look at actual tweets during the election, it seemed to be all Trump all the time.
Right.
Other politicians, including Barack Obama and others, were getting far more retweets, far more engagement, far more comments than Trump's tweets. But the media was picking up on those highly newsworthy, crazy tweets from Trump, and every day he was using Twitter to get in the New York Times, to get in all these other publications. So really, Twitter, I think the biggest impact is its total access to almost all journalists.
Isn't it the case, though, that all of this hand-wringing over Facebook and Twitter only started when Trump won the election? That before then... I would submit, and this is what we were talking about on Twit, Mike, I know you, it sounds like you listened, is I would submit that's because he figured out how to use both to great effect.
Mm-hmm. He's a troll. He's a troll. He's been a troll for years.
You can label it with a name, but
I mean,
the fact of the matter is he or that guy Pascal or whatever, he figured out how to use it better than anybody.
And it's interesting if you look at, this is something I think about often when it comes to Facebook and how to use it. Barack Obama's campaign, there were a number of really laudatory articles written about how well they were using digital media, in particular Facebook, and how they had figured out how to kind of mobilize their followers by using Facebook and so on, had all these digital smart guys figuring it out. And it was all very positive. And then as soon as Trump and the right wing did exactly the same thing, it became
hugely
negative.
It was not exactly the same thing. It wasn't exactly the same thing.
Different. But to be fair, what Obama did in 2008 was create a great digital group that understood these things. They collected a lot of numbers. I know they got mine because they said they want updates or whatever. And then they were able to use those numbers and those Facebook accounts in 2012 in the re-election. effectively.
But the massive, they used
targeting. But even what they did was
they used targeting.
They used targeting, but what they did was nothing compared with what Brad Parscale and the Trump right. team did. I mean,
the biggest difference.
I just thought
is
it was interesting that.
Go ahead, Mike, and then Matthew.
Yeah, I did. The biggest difference is that Obama organized self-selected supporters.
That's
people
right.
voluntarily That's signed right. up yeah. to be part of this movement. They organized that brilliantly. And that, and what the Trump campaign did was they used targeting to manipulate people who never even had any idea they were involved in anybody's political campaign. Right.
Well, and so, you could say, and I'm not sure if this is true, right. but we're looking into it. There's an interesting correlation between the Russian activities on Facebook, which very closely mirrored Trump's own strategies down to the state, mm-hmm. down to the localities. Whether there was communication between the two or not is yet to be determined. But yeah. maybe just the Russians were smart enough to see what Trump was going for and to support it. But it wasn't Trump's campaign by itself. He got a lot of help.
Right. And we're still debating, you know, how much of an effect that had on the election. Did it actually influence the outcome? This is something that even sociologists and experts in this type of stuff are not
I
clear
have to
on,
say, though, Matthew, it seems like the needle's moving more in the direction of it did.
I don't know. I thought so, too. There was one particular academic whose name escapes me now who just came out with a book.
Yes. That's who we were talking about.
She believes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it actually Twitter. Did.
Yeah.
Tip things over. So I've spoken to several sociologists who study this area, and they disagree. They don't think that there is as much evidence. But obviously, there's still a debate. The big question is, did it push people in a new direction, or did it just sort of reinforce things that they were already thinking or planning to do?
Well, it takes a village to lose an election. I paraphrase somebody who ran for president recently. We're not talking about whether the needle moved nationwide. There was no way Trump was ever going to win California. Right. We're talking about a couple of states or three states.
But that's how you win. You do it strategically. Those, you use the Electoral College to your advantage. And with an 80,000 vote margin, he was able to win.
Those same states where Hillary Clinton failed to go and press on those states.
Well, she didn't do a good job either. Yeah. Okay.
It was a combination of both of those things. And so, you know, it's hard, you know, at the end of the day, it's hard to lay blame.
I only bring this up in the context of if we get into that post-Newtonian moment, mm-hmm. when somebody writes Principia Social Networka, and maybe it's Brad Parscale, that's going to be a scary moment because, mm-hmm. and I think actually we might be seeing that moment where people have figured out, here's how you use the internet to sway opinion it's not just elections.
The biggest problem is not the persuasion of people in one political direction or another. The thing that the Soviet Union, the KGB discovered during the Soviet Union, was disinformatia, which is this where we get the word disinformation. The goal is not to persuade about something or another. The goal is to reduce and eliminate trust in any source of information. Right. And so nobody knows what's true. Everybody's like, well, who knows? And that's the thing that's being exported by Putin, former KGB officer. And the thing that kind of Trump is kind of picking up on as well. It works if you can get everybody both fearful and also confused about what's true, you can do all kinds
and
of
I
things.
I remember reading Facebook even before kind of the election and there was all the attention on the Russian Internet Research Agency. Facebook had an internal security report in which they discussed the actions of what appeared to be government actors or government influence actors. And they didn't specifically say Russia, which caused a bunch of controversy, and the head of security left partly as a result. But in the report, I remember them mentioning that it was interesting to see how much of the activity wasn't actually designed to be ideologically, you know, balanced in one way or the other, or ideologically sort of rigged to right or left. It was simply designed to confuse people and get them doubting even their own senses, doubting what was true, doubting who to believe. And, you know, that was enough to kind of just create chaos and kind of get people paralyzed with indecision.
And it, I think the most interesting fact about this, which is underappreciated, is the fact that the Russian trolls actually organized street marches successfully in the United States. People are marching in the streets.
Isn't that amazing?
Because Putin organized those protests.
Truly amazing.
It's astonishing.
Yeah. Matthew Ingram is here from the Columbia Journalism Review, and this all started because you said the bubble had burst in podcasting. You see what, Matthew? You see what you've done?
You never should have said it.
No, I completely agree. In fact, I've been hoping the bubble would burst. It's been awfully crowded in here.
You could use a bubble burst.
I want to buy my tulip bulbs in peace. Also, Mike Elgin, he's at elgin.com. There's a lot to talk about. In fact, let's when we come back, do the Google changelog. And you guys are all going to get up and walk out on me when? Soon? No? Oh, shoot. 2:55. Okay, remind me to say something nasty about Australia at 2:54. And then we can stage the greatest walkout. It'd be such a great moment. We might even get on Twitter if we do this right, kids.
It's called disinformation, kids.
Disinformatio. do.co/twig. Digital Ocean. And I am such a fan of Digital Ocean. Digital Ocean makes it easily the easiest cloud platform you can use. If you're a developer, if you're setting up a web service, an application service of any kind, you can deploy, manage, and scale applications so easily on DigitalOcean, and I love it. They call them droplets. Droplets are scalable virtual machines with add-on storage. You can add storage. You can add security. You can add monitoring capabilities. You can add backup. You can choose from standard or CPU-optimized droplets and customize from there. You get an easy-to-use control panel, an API that lets you spend more time coding, less time managing infrastructure, access to the compute resources you need at the lowest rates. In fact, I can't believe I've been running a blog on there for like $5 a month. I love it because once I create a droplet in DigitalOcean, I can use my SSH public key to log in, so it's very secure. They've really done a nice job of locking it down. 99.99% uptime, and it's an SLA, so they guarantee it. Cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise SSDs, and as I mentioned, that easy-to-use API. So let me think of an example we can do with this here. Let's say you're a 16-year-old in Australia and you like to write Python code and you have this great idea for an online game that you'd like to create. That sounds good, right? And maybe you'd like to do it for a couple of bucks. You don't have a lot of money, right? But you want to do a proof of concept. And what if it became popular? Well, you'd like to be able to scale it up. Let's create a new droplet. I'll show you how easy this is. You see, by the way, with Create, I can also add a lot of other things, cloud firewalls, floating IPs, load balancers, all sorts of stuff. Spaces is for storing and serving static assets. So if you had use a space for an image. Now, a couple of ways to do this. I can choose from Ubuntu, FreeBSD, Fedora, Debian, CentOS. But really, maybe I want to use a container distribution. Or how about a one-click app, Discourse, Doku, LAMP. Let's set up a LAMP stack or a MySQL stack, Ruby on Rails, WordPress, GitLab, PHP MyAdmin. You want to use Python? Let's use Django, right? That's the Python framework. So I'm going to click on Django. Now I have to choose the droplet size, everything from a $5 a month, 1 gigabyte memory, 1 virtual CPU, 25 gigabytes space, and a terabyte. That's actually quite a bit of storage. You can even pay for a backup if you want automatically. 20% of the droplet price, so that's like a buck. Block storage, let's pass on that. Now, where's your server? Amsterdam, Singapore, London, Frankfurt, Toronto, Bangalore. I always choose San Francisco, too. I like to add my SSH key to it. That way I can log in. And let's name this Leo's Django. So now this is going to be the Django framework running Now, let's see how long it takes to set Leo's Django up. Basically, I'm provisioning a server that I can use, that I can write code on, that I can post code on. It's public if I want it to be. I can add resources. If I write the ultimate tool, I can say, hey, it's a huge success. Yes, I spelled Django wrong. D-J-A-N-O-G. It's Leo's Jnog. Within a couple of minutes. I mean, when's the last time you set up a server? Last time you set up a server, you probably had to wait a day or two. Oh, yeah, we'll provision that. We'll let you know. We'll get back to you. Over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, use DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction, deliver industry-leading price performance, and boom, by the way, at 104.248.65.30, I've got a server running. It's running Django on Ubuntu. It's awesome. I can log in right here in a console. I can use SSH. I can program on it. That's how fast and easy it is. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to make it even more affordable because if you sign up today, you'll get a free $100 credit at do.co/twig. DigitalOcean. do.co/twig for a free $100 credit. I've used this for a long time for projects, for ideas, for blogging. It's all sorts of great things. Set up a wiki. Anything you can do on the internet, you can do at DigitalOcean. And you can get a $100 credit right now. do.co/twig. Leo Laporte with Matthew Ingram and Mike Elgin. Stacy and Jeff have the week off, but you know what doesn't get the week off ever? The Google changelog.
The Google changelog.
We brought this back for the 20th anniversary of Google. Are you laughing?
I love the drums. I love the drums.
Yeah. Some user, somebody made that for me some time ago. 20 years of Google. They celebrated their anniversary. It's unclear when exactly Google's actual anniversary is. Sometime in September, probably. There's when Google, you know, first incorporated. There's when, you know, there's various dates in here. But Google has, here's some of the numbers over 20 years. Google Maps has helped people find their way with driving directions in 240-plus countries, spanning 40 million miles of road, 83-plus trips to the moon and back, connecting people to 150 million places around the world. Google Assistant now in 20 languages. Translate lets you say thank you across 100 languages. So did you guys from Australia, did you use Translate when you got here so that people would understand? Yeah. Yeah. 143 billion words a day translated.
Is that all?
Is that all? It always blows me away when I see these stats from Google and Facebook and companies like that, just the volume of traffic they can handle. 500 million people use Google Photos every month. More than 1.2 billion photos and videos a day. Photos has freed up 410 petabytes worth of space on people's phones. Autocomplete and search estimates people, as they estimate people save 200 years of typing a day. 200 years of typing a day with autocomplete.
But it gets people to, it forces them to correct the word duck all the time.
I know what you mean. 1 billion people.
I almost never want to say duck.
You must have said duck once. That's why it's... your Google Assistant got a makeover this week. I don't know if you saw it on the phones. Didn't we talk about this last week? I feel like we talked. We didn't. So this is the new look of the Google Assistant.
It's
a lot better, isn't it? Yeah. Bigger visuals, new controls.
It's more compatible with two coming devices, one of which is the Pixel 3, which has a wireless dock that holds the phone up at a viewing angle. And so it looks like the Pixel 3 will be usable in its dock as a smart display. And then, of course, the Google Smart Display, which is forthcoming. It's basically a Google Home device with a screen. And so they're adding visual elements and touchscreen elements to the assistant and moving away from just, you know, text question, text answer. So it's very cool.
I quickly want to buy Leo.page. but I'm sure it's already too late. That's the new top-level domain from Google Registry, .page.
I'm sure Larry.page is taken.
Larry's got one.
Yeah.
So does Ellen. Ellen Page. Home.page. Christopher Neiman.page. Web.page. I see all the good pages are gone. Turn the page. Word as image.
Leo.page looks available.
How do I get it? Quick.
I have no idea.
Google Registry. Oh, I know there's people out there doing it right now.
It's hurry, probably too
hurry,
late.
Hurry. I'd like to add, if you're interested in register, follow register. Oh, I have to go through somebody. Oh, man. Oh, forget it. I have lost it already. Dang it. Why did I? I wasn't thinking. They also have .how and .. I don't understand Japanese. I don't know what that means. What is that? Anybody speak Japanese? What does that mean?
Everyone.
Dot everyone. Yep. That's awesome.
You have a page then.
Everyone's got that page. How do I type that in, though?
Try your best.
Good advice.
You know, I'm going to put that on my business card.
I know you can do it.
Yeah. I'm putting that on my business card. Leo.squiggles. Leo.everyone. How do you say it?
What's Leo doing? Best.
Minna. Yeah. It's Japanese. Yeah. Minna. Leo, I love that, but I think I'll take Paige instead, if you don't mind. I'm gonna miss out on Paige. Can we hold the release of this podcast for an extra hour while I... Yes. Too late. We do it live. There is a new mini in town. Looks like a mint. It's a new Aqua Google Home Mini. How exciting is that? Look, I didn't say it would all be good. It's just new stuff from Google. New Android app.
It actually might be cool. The Google Home thing might be might connect to a greater hub that is like controls the home and stuff like that. Could be the beginning. Remember, does anybody remember Android? What was it? Android Home or something like that? Google like 5 years ago introduced this new home operating system.
What?
And then at Google I/O, Android at Home or something like that, and then it just fizzled and went away, and nobody ever heard from it again. But they were like demoing stuff and pretty amazing. And so I think they're finally getting around to that, and they have to compete with Amazon, which is definitely wants to control your home. Yeah. We'll see. I think it's going to be a lot more capable than the current one. It's going to look exactly the same, but it's going to be much more capable.
Is it a software platform or is it a hardware platform?
It's similar, except it's going to support both Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. And so it seems like that the addition of Bluetooth is going to be really interesting for the platform, because it's like, what are they connecting to? Right now, we really don't know, but it's... you know, we're a week away from finding out. So it should be cool. I think that product is going to surprise people quite a bit. I just don't know how.
We will be streaming the event. It starts 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern time on Tuesday, October 9th. And we hope to learn some very interesting things. Certainly new Pixel phone. And you said there'll be a new charging stand or grasping stand?
It's a cradle for wireless charging.
How do you know about this? Appears,
there's a leaked renders from that they're going to show at the event on the 9th. Uh-huh. And they got out there. They look perfectly legitimate. But it's basically a round disc, plugs in with probably USB-C at the bottom, and then it holds the phone at an angle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it looks cool. And again, I think they're really shooting for expanding the usage of the smart display by actually turning Google phones into a smart display. And hopefully
I got a charger for my phone that would do that, that would hold it up at an angle like that specifically because I wanted to see it. It actually just rotates photos, but still, it's another display you could use for different things.
the reports on this one are that there's going to be a completely different display for when it's in that mode. So when you're like in, you're in smart, and it'll probably be very similar to the Google smart display product that they're going to be announcing. It'll essentially probably be a Google smart display. So it'll just completely convert over to that when you plug it into this device.
Hmm. By the way, I've just been trying to register Leo.page. Hoping you would keep talking.
How's Google, it going?
Well, I went to Google Domains and said, you can't do that till October 9th. So this is going to be a big day, October 9th.
Can you grab Jimmy.page?
We did see, I did get an email because I'm a Google Fi customer saying that pre-orders will begin immediately after the event for whatever it is they announce.
Nice.
So I presumably that's the Pixel 3 that they're talking about.
I'm torn because I really want an Apple Watch, but I would rather have the Pixel 3. So I'm kind of on the fence right now whether I go with the Watch or the Pixel 3.
For people who were hoping to keep their old Pixel alive, good news, Google has launched a repair service for older Pixels. This is from Android Police. Eventually, we'll cover all four Pixel phones. That's a good thing because basically, if you have one of the old Pixels, good luck trying to get it fixed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's good. That's showing some corporate responsibility. It's really a shame when you get these things and they just, after 2 years, they're obsolete and you can't get them fixed and you have to throw them out and they're perfectly good. They just want to sell new stuff.
I bought my Pixel Book at Best Buy and I was kind of in a rush and I went to buy it and I'm like, I'll go sign up for the Google Care, whatever it's called, later.
Right.
And then when I went to sign up for it, they're like, nope, you can only get that if you buy it from the Google directly. And so now I have this Pixel Book that's really, I got the high-end one, so it's pretty expensive. And I have no coverage. There's to the best of my knowledge, there's no plan to repair it, I guess, other than bringing it back to Best Buy, which is like, wow, not sure I want to do that. So they really need to get their act together if they're going to compete in any way against Apple, because Apple's just, everybody knows you can just take it to your friendly neighborhood Apple store, mm-hmm. go to the Genius Bar. They'll probably fix it. Apple's light years ahead of Google on, and it's not about the repairs as much as it is about, getting people to purchase in the first place. The knowledge that they're going to have this service is going to really facilitate people buying Pixels, I think.
Have you used the new Google Maps with the special commute tab enabled?
No.
I work from home, so I commuted.
There's no tab for your cross home commute? Well, I don't really have much of a commute either. But what's really good, and this is something I'm really glad they added, you can do mixed mode commutes. So you could drive, walk, and take mass transit. And it will put them all together for you, which is great, including a arrival time based on all three of those. So that's coming to Google Maps and iOS and Android any minute now.
Pay attention to which mode you're in, because I had an experience where I got directions when we were in Italy and almost drove down a staircase because I was in walk mode as opposed to driving mode.
Probably a marble staircase.
Don't do that.
Isn't that what happened in the Italian job?
In Italy, you're allowed to do that, I think. Yeah. But,
no, you are. Still. No, I saw the movie. By the way, it's not just Google. Nobody's offering the .page domain until October 9th. But, hey, thank you, GoDaddy. I can pre-register it at GoDaddy, which they said increases my chance, maximizes my chance of getting it for a meal $669.99.
That seems worth it.
If I want priority pre-registration, which lines up ahead of everyone waiting for general availability and increases my chance of getting this domain, it's a mere $819.99.
Wow.
So thank you, GoDaddy. I think Google said we're going to charge $12.
And that's why you won't actually find Leo.page.
That's why I'll never find it, because somebody will pay $800 to get it.
Right. I'd pay that much for Larry.page.
What? You better think Larry's got that locked in. I don't. How did Ellen Page get it? How did these?
You got to know somebody.
She pays somebody to do that.
I don't know what this means, but I like the name. Reimagining the commercial break with advanced TV solutions. under the right? What could possibly be wrong with that? This is Google Ad Manager, delivering seamless experiences on all screens, dynamic ad insertion. What everybody wants this smarter TV ad breaks. Optimize your commercial breaks for the highest revenue based on the most relevant combinations of ads customized for each viewer. Well, how would they customize them for me? How do they know what I want to see?
Oh, they know.
That's what I love about Google. You know, on one hand, they say, you know, we respect your privacy. On the other hand, if you go to the ad blogs, they say, hey, you want to know what that guy did with his credit card the other day? We could tell you.
We respect your privacy because that's our whole business plan, is selling your privacy.
That's why we respect it.
Yeah. So this is I see this as a trend that is mostly associated with Amazon. So, for example, Amazon was the alternative to brick and mortar stores. And now they're talking about launching thousands of brick and mortar stores. Everybody's confused. Wait, I thought they were the anti brick and mortar, but that's never been the case. What Amazon represents is commerce that's algorithmically driven, that's, you know, has all this tracking, all this kind of stuff. This is another example of that. I thought YouTube was the anti TV. No, not really. It's basically algorithmically driven, customized advertising, theoretically. I actually think Google is not very good at producing customized ads, not as good as Facebook has become recently. But we're going to see Google breaking into TV in one way or another. And, you know, they're already everybody's TV set under the age of whatever it is, 20. And so it's really not about TV versus online. It's really about, are you just sending out mass ads to everybody, advertising beer and tires for the sports fans and, you know, et cetera? Or are you customizing based on purchase history, web activity, and all that kind of stuff? And that's the business they're in. It doesn't matter if it's TV or not. So I think we're going to see a lot of that, where these algorithmically generated, you know, that live and die by algorithms are going to break into, I guess, the real world or the analog world, whatever you want to call it, in any way they can, because that's really their model, is to use algorithms and tracking and personalization to sell more stuff.
So my only fear is that this future will be much like the web is now for me, where I go to a site and it says, would you like to buy the pair of shoes that you just finished buying?
Yeah, I love those recommendations. I mean, Amazon does that all the time. Yeah. All the things I just bought.
I literally just bought it. No, I don't need another one.
One's enough. Thanks. I read that book already.
What I'm confused about, and maybe somebody has a handle on this, the best contextual advertising by far is on Instagram. I literally want every single thing they advertise to me.
Isn't
on Instagram.
That amazing?
And there's no other site that does it.
All these kids are nodding. Yeah. How many of you have bought something on an Instagram ad? And I should hold up both hands. I took Instagram off my phone. I just deactivated my account. I used to wake up in the middle of the night and I'd be bored. I'd flip through Instagram. Invariably, I'd buy something at 3 a.m. Invariably.
Yeah.
The underwear I'm wearing right now, I bought on Instagram. You want to see
at 3 a.m? No.
Why did you get rid of your account?
That's why. What do you, why did I get rid of it? Because I was waking up at 3 a.m. going on Instagram and buying crap. It's like worse than the home shopping channel.
So
is that or hitting the ice cream?
Poor impulse control.
Well, I guess you could say it's my fault. Or you could say, as Mike just did, they really nailed the algorithm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are pretty good at it, I have to say.
Have you ever bought anything on Instagram?
I have come close, but every time before I do a Google search for whoever's selling it. And in almost every case, it looks like it wouldn't be a great deal. So
yeah, see, that's the thing. It works on the phone. You're not likely to do anything but just. And then the other thing that they've really made too easy is between Apple Pay and Amazon Pay, I don't have to fill out a credit card. I just press a button and it's on its way.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
I did something really weird.
I'm sorry to step
ahead,
over you, Matthew. I did something really weird, which I think says a lot about online commerce. So I saw this really cool thing on Instagram. I had to have it. It was basically this orange, you've probably seen it too. It's this orange hockey puck thing that gives you a Wi-Fi hotspot.
I bought it.
Yeah. Well, you shouldn't have, because
Leo has five of them.
It's like a form of showrooming, except there's no showroom involved at all. So I went to Amazon to check the reviews, because where else are you going to get reviews that are that clear and that numerous? So I went to Amazon, read the reviews, and decided not to buy it, which I think is a really interesting phenomenon. Amazon reviews are actually a really good guide for certain products about whether or not you should buy them, because not only you can go straight to the one-star reviews and find out what the, and if you see a common thread, oh, this really, you know, everybody was saying, oh, it slows way down after, you know, a trivial amount of traffic. It slows way down.
That's exactly what's wrong with it. Yep.
Yes. And how many people said that?
Recommendation-wise, I think Amazon's recommendations are probably the best I've ever seen and have been for a long time. Not just people who bought this also bought this, but things that it recommends based on your browsing history. They're almost always things I'm either interested in buying or thinking about buying, or like they're just extremely good at that stuff.
Yeah.
I actually like this Skyrim Solus, but the 500 megabyte. But see,
it was
too late. I'd already bought it. Yeah, we just used it on our last trip, and that's where the 500 megabyte limit, daily limit, really bit us. We paid $99. You can have five devices connected because it's Wi-Fi. We carry it around as we'd walk around. But I think it's less necessary now because of Google Fi and T-Mobile.
Yeah.
We got just as fast on our phones, and we could hotspot them, and we already had it.
See, my carrier has a Roam like home things. So you pay $10 a day.
Yep.
You're basically using your account like you were at home.
Yep. So in a way, I mean, I think this was a good idea, but I think times have changed. Alas.
Yeah. Yep.
It is interesting though. I wonder whether Instagram, are they better at feeding you things that you are actually interested in because it's a specifically image based, you know, you're literally just scrolling through images and liking things, and that I think provides a huge amount of kind of data on
what
visually being tracked.
Let's not forget every 8th post is an ad, but all the posts in between are often ads. Did you read this article in today's New York Times? A penthouse made for Instagram. $15,000 a month in New York City, 2,400 square feet, free of the clutter of everyday life because no one lives there.
Yeah.
Instagram influencers rent it by the day. It's booked through the month of October already to post pictures. So here's the bedroom. By the way, furniture from Wayfair. And here's an Instagram post from an Instagram influencer advertising apparently her bra. Recently, I discovered Be Tempted bras. I haven't been happier. This is an Instagram post. This should be illegal. Well, it does say ad in there, but I mean, there are more ads on Instagram than their regular posts.
Talk about advertiser supported.
There was a piece recently, I can't remember who did it, but it was all about kids basically having a summer job that just consists of posting sponsored content on Instagram.
And if you want to be a real Instagram influencer, have a baby. That's really useful.
Mm. Yeah, it helps.
Or a puppy.
It really helps. Cheryl Lee Lyle, Soho, Manhattan, selling. What do you think she's selling there?
Cupcakes.
Nope. That's what I thought. It's that soft Roma t-shirt or sweatshirt she's wearing. More on my cozy new sweatshirt and this adorable interior by Wayfair on my stories now. You want to see more?
Ad, though,
does it not say ad? Uh-oh. She's in trouble with the FTC. They're coming for you, Cheryl. No, they're not.
So this penthouse thing is a mirror of a company that's existed in Russia for a while, since at least a year, which will rent a private jet so you can take pictures of yourself on a private jet. It never leaves the tarmac. It just sits there.
No. I think Dan Bilzerian uses that. I think that's...
Yeah, he probably does.
He's always going somewhere in his private jet.
But something disturbing occurred to me about Instagram influencers. They often mock everyday situations, even though they're staged. So, for example, one common theme of a lot of influencers is they show them getting up in the morning or going to bed at night, especially getting up in the morning. But they get up in the morning, their makeup is on, their hair is done, they look perfect, the whole room is perfect, everything's wonderful. How is this different from the king of France at Versailles, who staged a going to bed and getting up ceremony every day, and all the sycophants would gather around, and then they'd, after everybody would tiptoe away, they'd go into their real bedroom and actually go to bed.
Louis would have loved Instagram.
What an influencer.
Après-moi le Instagram. So this, the one thing I missed on Instagram, speaking of these staged things, is Kirby Jenner. This is actually a very funny comic who poses as the fraternal twin of Kendall Jenner. He'll take Kendall Jenner's real pictures and Photoshop him into them in hysterical ways. He's not in this picture. He gets dressed up to match.
Nice.
Yeah. So it actually... This is a really great send-up of everything that's wrong with Instagram, incidentally. So that's a real Kirby Jenner post with him added. And I'm sorry if you're listening and you're not seeing these pictures, but just do me a favor, follow him on Instagram, Kirby Jenner.
There was quite a disturbing piece, actually, earlier this year about a girl who basically lives her life for Instagram. I think she was 18 at the time, I think, and not really, you know, nobody famous, but her parents were wealthy enough that she went to some pretty good parties, I guess, and she got marketers interested in kind of promoting their products through her Instagram, and it was kind of depressing in a way because she had no real life. Her entire life consisted of kind of faking a life in order to promote products on
it's
Instagram.
Really sad. I mean, where is she now? You got to wonder, you know, this poor girl, her values have been completely warped, right?
Leo, yeah, can you go back three?
Yes. Which one would you like?
Keep going. One more. Okay, look, that's his sleeve. Look at how long his sleeve is.
He says, whoa, I won the award for longest sleeves at this Met Jingle Ball thing, and this is a real big moment for me. Shout out to Reggie at Men's Warehouse for hooking it up, like always, my Uber driver for her patience, and Janet the caterer who fed me snacks all night because I couldn't find my own hands.
That's a great look.
So this is the real Kendall Jenner at the Met Gala with him. But he doesn't do a whole lot of posts because it takes forever. He's got to get the outfit. He's got to... Oh, wait a minute. Here's a video. Kylie said, if this video gets over 50 million views, she'll let me have my garage sale at her house. Kirby. Kylie. He is, I think, the most talented person I have ever seen.
Certainly the most talented of all the Kardashians.
He's the best Kardashian.
Oh, easily.
Yeah, he's definitely the best. All right, we hadn't finished the Google changelog, but we got really distracted here. I have one more thing that you're going to very much like, and I bet you all of the young people here in the audience will be excited about this. Do you like Assassin's Creed? Fun game, right? Can you imagine, you know, your school stuck you with Chromebooks? You can't play any games, but wait. Google Project Stream is bringing Assassin's Creed Odyssey to your Chrome browser. Oh, but wait, I'm sorry, the fine print. Your internet connection has to be capable of 25 megabits a second. You must be 17 years or older and live in the U.S. to participate. Aww.
That's pretty cool, though.
In your browser.
Yeah.
This is really, it makes sense. They're accepting, you have to get an invite. You could apply on the website right now if you meet all those criteria. 25 megabits isn't that much nowadays. I think there's a lot of people with that.
I'll be interested to see how this works, like in real life.
They don't, I'm looking at the sign up. They don't say specifically what kind of hardware you need, but I'm thinking this is, you got to have a Pixelbook or you're using Chrome on a fairly hefty PC.
Yeah, I'm totally doing this.
Isn't that awesome?
I got a Pixelbook. Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
Assassin's Creed
think by
Odyssey.
The end of the October 9th announcement, everybody's going to think that Pixelbooks and high-end Chromebooks are like the most capable devices. I believe the Windows 10 rumors, for example.
The rumor is there'll be a tablet. Yeah. I think a fairly good rumor. Kevin Toffel was talking about this from aboutchromebooks.com last week. Fairly good rumor that there will be a new tablet called codenamed Nocturne or Pixel Slate. that doesn't have a keyboard, but has their third-party keyboards like the Bridge. That's how we learned about it, a keyboard that can be attached to it. It'll be a fairly high resolution, a 3x2 screen, run Android. And that's the rumor that's most interesting, that will may also run Windows 10.
The good money is on the idea that the this Nocturne tablet will get it immediately or soon enough, and that the Pixelbook could get it immediately. And it's only a matter of time, you know, 6 months or whatever, where there'll be a half a dozen to a dozen devices that will run this, the Windows 10. So pretty cool.
Are you at all worried about the idea of a tablet version of Chrome OS, or does that sound good to you? Because I've only seen one. It was from Acer, and it was unimpressive.
Well, the thing is that the Pixelbook folds into a tablet, but it's irritating to use because the back is a keyboard. And even though the keyboard's disabled in the tablet mode, it's still super annoying to use it with a keyboard in the back. Yeah. And so a tablet mode is going to need an entirely different interface. I've used my Pixelbook a lot in tablet mode, and just, you know, just tapping around and using touch for the browser and stuff like that does not work. A lot of missed pokes. And so they really have to change the interface, and I hope they do. Essentially, when you put any Chromium or Chrome OS device into tablet mode, or if it's a tablet, it should just kick into a completely different interface that's a lot more like iOS or the Android interface. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great idea. It's a great device. Right now, Google does some things that are interesting. For example, there's certain things that you need a keyboard to do, and as soon as you put it in tablet mode, those things go down and become selectable on the bottom display thing. They just need to do a lot more of that kind of thing in order to make it viable. But I think it's doable, and I think it would be great if they could do that. Because again, you know, you add a Bluetooth keyboard to a tablet. That's how I have used my iPad since 2010. It's great to have a separate, completely separate keyboard from a tablet that's a you know, dedicated tablet.
Yeah, but is it covered in leather?
I hope so.
Did you see this? The HP Spectre Folio, the first laptop. This isn't a leather case, a leather cover. This is actually a leather laptop.
Leather laptop for you leather enthusiasts.
You want leather, you've got it. And the reason I thought of this is because it does have a kind of a, it doesn't, this keyboard does not detach, but it has, you know, kind of, it's a convertible. So it kind of, and you can see as it floats down, there's a one point position where the trackpad is still accessible. I'm not sure exactly what the idea there is, but, and it's running Windows 10, so. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that because this has been the extended edition of the Google Changelog. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Our show today brought to you by Capterra. If you if you're looking for business software for your business, whether you're you have a window washing business, you're a veterinarian, you're a dentist, you want to, you know, you do sales and you want to keep track of customers, there are really only a couple ways to do it. You could Google it and get a bunch of just kind of undifferentiated results and then have to comb through it and figure out what's good, what's not. You could ask a friend, but, you know, your friend better be pretty well connected. Let me give you the best way. Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/twig. We all face unexpected hurdles at work, but don't let finding the right software for your business be one of them. 2019 is fast approaching. Man, I didn't think I'd be saying that anytime soon, but it is. You don't have time for unexpected hurdles to derail you. Find software for your business fast with Capterra. You can use the site, but they've got a new free ebook you might want to check out, The Big Book of Free Software. It's free. It's a free resource to help you find the software you need for your business. 300 different software tools. It'll help you find a completely free tool to test today. Yeah, everything in here is free. And even the book is free. So you don't even have to ask your boss for any money. You just go out and get it. Capterra.com/twig. Whether you're looking for a new project management tool, e-commerce software, an email marketing solution, Capterra's big book of free software, did I mention it's free? Is there for you. Visit Capterra.com/twig and get your copy of The Big Book of Free Software. Absolutely free. You couldn't really charge for a big book of free software, so they're giving it away. Capterra is a great resource for finding the business software you need. It makes it easy. And now you get free, the big book of free software, capterra.com/twig. Join the millions of smart people who use Capterra every single week. Are they talking about this in Canada? California has enacted a net neutrality law, joining a number of other states. It seemed like, you know, when I read it, it seemed like, you know, not a big deal. The net neutrality law basically reinstates the old FCC rule that internet service providers can't block sites, slow down sites, can't zero rate sites. In other words, let some sites be free on their service while others are not. Immediately, the Department of Justice sued and many other ISPs. Because apparently, despite the fact that the FCC says we don't need this regulation because nobody really wants to do this, everybody wants to do it. I mean, isn't this an admission basically by the United States government that the whole point of eliminating net neutrality is so that internet service providers could slow down sites, block sites, and zero rate sites?
Pretty much.
Well, the Justice Department wants to basically rule that it's unconstitutional for a state to regulate interstate commerce.
That's actually in the Constitution, that the federal government regulates interstate commerce.
Exactly. The problem with that line of argument has been tested in court before. And what was determined in the existing precedent is that, in fact, states can do that. And the reason they can do that is because the Ajit Pai FCC, in their reversal of the Obama-era ruling for net neutrality, essentially argued that the internet should not be or will not be regulated by the federal government, and therefore private companies can do pretty much whatever they want.
Right.
And so what is likely to happen, according to legal experts, is that when this goes into court, they're saying, no, you guys ruled that you cannot regulate this stuff. So you can't, if you can't regulate it, then you can't tell states they can't regulate it, and therefore states are allowed to regulate it. And this is going to happen. I think that California's net neutrality law is going to prevail in court, and it'll be another shining example of competence and so on by the current FCC.
I hope you're right. I understand the constitutional objection, but the California legislatures who created this law say, we specifically wrote a law that would not infringe on the Constitution. I think you made an excellent point. The federal government has already said we're not going to regulate it. So how could this be competing with the federal government? And when I read what this law does, I wonder how an internet service provider or the Department of Justice, all of whom are suing the state, explain the fact that they've said, well, we don't want to do this. They're trying to preserve the right to do this. The new California law prohibits. See, what do you think about this? You think it should be against the law for internet service providers to block or throttle lawful traffic? Should it be against the law for them to require fees from websites or online services like Twit to deliver or prioritize traffic to consumers? Should ISPs be allowed to zero rate? Should they be allowed to evade net neutrality protections by slowing down traffic at network interconnect points? All of this seems sensible. No, they shouldn't be able to do that.
But part of their argument is that they need to do some of those things or want to in certain cases. So throttling, for example, for network congestion purposes. So their argument would be, yes, we don't want to throttle all of this company's traffic, but we might want to do what they call in Canada bandwidth shaping for specific purposes. And that might be misconstrued as, I'm not saying I agree with this argument, but I think that's part of what the reason they're complaining is that they feel this would criminalize things that they already do.
Zero rating, it would.
Lots of companies do.
It would
do.
Criminalize things they already do. Exactly my point.
The trouble is that it's much more complicated because really from the ISP's point of view, there are two internets. There's the internet that goes from the world to the ISP, and then the internet that goes from the ISP to the customer of the ISP. And if you're throttling the latter one, the connection to the customer, based on if you're prioritizing different services based on any deals you made or whether you happen to own those sources of information, then that is clearly a violation. That's akin to a company building a toll road and then blocking traffic on the actual road and routing different people for different reasons and so on. Clearly a violation. However, there are certain things like, you know, a huge percentage of the internet's traffic is Netflix and YouTube. Mm-hmm. And so there's all kinds of things that they have to do between Netflix and YouTube to give prioritization. Huge investment. YouTube and Netflix pay a lot to the ISPs for some of this activity. And that's an entirely different kettle of fish.
Peering agreements.
Desirable for, exactly, peering agreements, et cetera. And so it's very, very complicated. But it's essentially what we have here is a conflict between a state administration, the Jerry Brown administration, which is acting on behalf of consumers and enacting a clear consumer protection bill, and the FCC, which is acting clearly against consumers in favor of companies. And this is essentially how Washington tends to work anyway. And it couldn't be more clear cut in that regard. I mean, the devil is in the details, and the California bill is not perfect. But this is what we're talking about: is does freedom mean that consumers have the freedom to get unbiased access to everything on the internet, or does freedom mean that Comcast has the right to charge and nickel and dime and throttle and play games with a consumer in order to make more money? What? How do you define freedom? It's clear how the FCC defines it.
Well, the Department of Justice does not always win. According to Reuters, the U.S., which is trying to force Facebook to wiretap messenger calls in their investigation of the Fresno MS-13 gang, has failed. The proceedings were sealed, so we only know that the judge at the U.S. District Court of Fresno ruled in Facebook's favor. It said Facebook does not have to decrypt those messages. Right. We don't know why. But Reuters has two people briefed on the sealed ruling, who are saying that Facebook, in fact, has won this case.
Yeah. This is whenever they every generation has its unassailable bad people. Whether, you know, a few years ago it was Al-Qaeda,
right.
It's always child pornographers. Now MS-13 is something everybody's afraid of. And the typical playbook is that you, law enforcement or some other government agency, wants to be able to do certain things, and judges or some other group in the government says, no, you can't do that because of annoying things like the Constitution or the existing statutes. And then they always come back with, oh, but the, you know, child pornography, we have to stop the, you know, whatever it is that nobody could argue is a good thing to stop, MS-13 in this case. You always have to be, everybody should be wary of these examples, because they will always come back with that example, that reason why they need to do something generally that they've always wanted to do.
And it's a great way to get voters to the polls is to scare them.
Yeah. That's exactly right. That's why. What's his name's book is called Fear. Bob Woodward's book. The reason it's called Fear is that it's based on this idea, this political idea that scaring the daylights out of everybody gets you a lot of power. And so lots and lots. I wrote a piece on this. I call it the Fear Industrial Complex. And you know, lots and lots of different companies have discovered if you can make people scared enough, they will give you either power or money or both. And so, that's essentially the sign of the times. So we need to learn to recognize those things when they're coming at us.
Hitler used, it's been used time immemorial to create a scapegoat and to make people scared of them and then say, well, I have the solution. Only I can solve this problem. What's changed is the ability of people to, as we began the conversation, to use modern technologies, internet technologies, to spread this. And we could scare people really good now. We got it down, man. We could terrify you.
My mother-in-law got a phone call out of the blue that said, "Oh, we've recognized your so and so activity. We're going to be coming to your place of business or your home to forfeit. You're going to have to forfeit your home and all this kind of stuff," and just scared the daylights out of her. I mean, and I looked it up and did some research, and it turns out that this is a scam that starts in India. They tunnel into like a U.S. VoIP, and then they make phone calls and leave messages. And it's just like there's no attempt to persuade or con or trick. It's just like scare people, and the money flows. And it's just a really awful thing that they're essentially trolling for people like my mother-in-law who don't really understand what's happening.
It works better with older people, that's for sure. Now that I'm an older person, I'm getting a lot more of those calls. This happened, I think, last week when the new iPhone came out. I got a call during all the shows. They called me a total of 14 times in one day saying, "Your iCloud account has been hacked." Hi, this is Olivia from Apple support. Your iCloud account has been hacked. It was a robocall. Please call us at this number. And whatever you do, don't use any Apple services until you do.
Right.
Of course, immediately I went to iCloud to see if I'd been hacked, and I hadn't. But, you know those things are scams almost immediately. It doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. I know a friend, her mother was on the way when she called her. She was on her way to the bank to take money out to send a money order to someone who claimed that her network had been hacked. And this was the only way to get, she was literally on the way to the bank to take money out to give to some complete stranger. And if her daughter hadn't called, she probably would have.
Well, I know for a fact, and maybe this is something I don't know a lot of people have talked about, but that all of these scammers, all these callers are coming from Australia. This is actually...
Yeah, it's Australia.
Many people don't know this. You know, they think, oh, it's Russians, but it's Australia. They're all coming
the worst.
They're going to leave. Oh. I think we have to play them a special song as they... Thank you. Thank you, young people. Play the song out, will you, Karsten, as the procession...
Is it The Land Down Under?
Australians, let us rejoice, for we are young and free. We've golden soil and wealth for toil. Our home is girt by sea. What the hell's girt mean?
Girt. You don't see that word a lot anymore.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So long. Catch you later, mate. Bye-bye. Thank God we got rid of them. Man, were they downers.
Stirring.
Hey, you know it'd be a great idea for a podcast, because I know you don't have enough podcasts to deal with, Leo. A podcast that focuses on scams, that identifies as a major scam and then follows through on it. Like the podcast
where does this come from? Who is doing this? Yeah, that's a great idea.
Right, interact with the Nigerian like scammer and like go back and forth with them and like I don't know.
That's the next serial. Because what you do if you did the Nigerian, what do they call it, the 444 scam or whatever, if you did that, if you did it, it would take a long period of time because, you have to write, it'd be really next week.
Yeah. Have you seen the comedian who does that?
No.
Who responds it's fantastic. There's a whole routine where he basically responds to a Nigerian scammer and pretends to be interested and then asks for photos of him and his family, and it's quite funny.
There used to be a website full of things like that where people would say, "Well, we need you to prove that you're legit, so we want you to put a fish on your head and like stand on one foot."
Okay, I'll do that. I hope that those nice children from Australia who are going home are not going to go through New Zealand, because a new law has been passed in New Zealand, went into effect October 1st. The Customs and Excise Act allows New Zealand Customs to carry out digital strip searches. Previously, Customs in New Zealand could stop anyone at the border and demand to see their electronic devices. The updated law says travelers must provide the password, the PIN code, the fingerprint to unlock that device or be subject to a fine up to $5,000, and the device will be seized and forensically searched anyway. The New Zealand Customs spokesperson Terry Brown said, "It's a file-by-file search on your phone. We're not going into the cloud. We'll examine your phone while it's in flight mode." And basically that says, so if you're a bad guy, just store everything in Google Docs.
In the cloud, yeah.
Yeah. And you're cool.
Just but, take a burner
phone. Yeah, which is why they'll amend the rule in like a year to include the cloud and social networks. You have to provide your social networking passwords, et cetera. It's a slippery slope for sure.
They're worried about...
I assumed that ICE and, you know, Border Patrol were doing this, not New Zealand.
You never know where it's coming from, and maybe they'll say, oh, that's a good idea.
You know,
we know that the FBI actually is getting now, it's routine in warrants, and it's recently happened in an FBI search warrant, the right to hold the phone up to a perpetrator's face to unlock it.
Oh, really? Interesting.
The FBI was able to force a suspect to unlock his Apple iPhone 10 with his face, and it is apparently being written into search warrants on a regular basis now.
So as far as I understand the legal precedent so far, they can compel you to do things that involve using your body, so your fingerprint, your eye scan, your face, but...
Yes, because for years they've been able to take a fingerprint or take hair for DNA.
But they're not allowed to force you to reveal a code.
Yeah, because that's the contents of your brain.
Speech.
Of your brain, exactly. Yeah.
But because it's speech.
All of this relies on courts that continue to uphold that principle, and there is absolutely no guarantee that that's going to happen.
The advice that I've read is, yes, technically you can say court precedent doesn't give you the right to force me to reveal a code. And they can say, fine, you can sit in the slammer for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, you get to sit in airplane jail. Believe me, airport jail is the worst jail. You don't want to be in airport jail.
I've been there.
This is one of the things I love about a Chromebook is you can just power wash it, and there's literally nothing on the device, nothing that can be even extracted from the hard drive and so on. But, you know, there are a lot of these things that changes in what happens as you travel around the world in terms of your security and privacy. A lot of things are like stories like New Zealand. And in almost every case, I'm like, well, that's an interesting story as a journalist. I need to cover that, be aware of that. But for me personally, traveling, it doesn't.
Yeah, because you're an old white man.
Yeah, exactly.
Wear a turban, see what happens, Mike.
Okay, right. True. But there's a story that came out today that actually did freak me out. And that story is that a German man was detained in Turkey for defaming Erdogan on social media years ago. I have personally defamed Erdogan myself and the Cuban government and lots of, you know, you name it. So I'm thinking, this is the first time I've ever thought, you know what? Yeah. What do I need these old? I'm just going to delete all my old posts, because at some point this thing is going to snowball to the point where I'm not going to get into some of these countries anymore.
The first thing before I deactivated my Twitter account, that's the first thing I did, is I ran a script that deleted all my old tweets, every one of them.
Fantastic.
And I think that that's probably a good idea, although tweets live forever regardless of what you might do, because there's plenty of, they're stored in lots of places. But I agree with you. I think I would stay out of Turkey. You know, we were in Italy, Mike, you couldn't move, and Amalfi or Positano was jammed with tourists. Of course, it's high season in September, but our guide said it's gotten much worse because people aren't going to Turkey and Egypt.
Right. Interesting.
So this is why the places like Italy and Provence and are getting so crowded. Yeah. Barcelona, because the number of places that people, the tourists, want to go is narrowing. There's one idea that I think is kind of an interesting idea that I think Matt Drudge, it's either Drudge Report on Twitter or Matt Drudge on Twitter. They post one tweet, they delete. There's always one tweet there. And when they do a new tweet, they delete the existing tweet and then tweet another one. So you can go to the site, I think it's Matt Drudge, always exactly one tweet. And that sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, but again, it may not be on Twitter, but it's still there. Yeah. I mean, I deactivated my account, but it doesn't mean it's not.
I know I've thought about going, you know, crossing the border to get into the U.S. and having someone check my Twitter feed and see things that I've said about Donald Trump and decide that, you know, I'm not welcome in the country.
Yep. And then there's always Lindsay Lohan, who could punch you in the airport in France. So
and might. And might.
Apparently,
yeah, she might.
Apparently will. Yeah, I have not had any. Boy, we travel a lot. I have never had problems coming into the United States. More trouble going into Canada than ever getting into the United States because I'm a U.S. citizen. But the Canadians are tough. You guys are tough,
but fair.
Tough. You don't want to mess with a Mountie. I'm telling you, those guys, they're scary.
Did I tell you about coming back from San Francisco and going through Canadian customs in Pearson, and this large, you know, marine-looking guy with a haircut and weapons and whatnot was very serious, and he said, "Are you Matthew Ingram?" And I was like, I'm pretty sure maybe. I am, but why? And he said, like, the Matthew Ingram? And I'm like, am I on a list or something?
The one T Matthew Ingram?
And he said, "Are you on that show with Leo Laporte this week in Google?" And I'm like, yeah. He said, "I love that show. I love that show." Yeah, and then we had this great chat about whatever we were discussing that week.
I'm always very aware of the fact that that we have listeners in every walk, and that's why I really try to be fair. And I'm sure that was the guy a security guy.
Yeah, and he said, "I have some different views when it comes to like encryption." And
I can understand that they're right on the front line there.
You should like totally get in the chat room or something because we would love to hear from you.
Yeah, I mean, I always ask law enforcement when they come in. We get a lot of law enforcement visiting. And I always ask them, and they often do come down on the other side. But remember, they're on the front lines, and they're looking for every tool they can get. But it isn't. But I think most of them understand that there's a natural tension between the need to police and the right to freedom. That's why we have a constitution, and that's a lot of the things in the constitution make it harder for police. Privacy makes it harder for police. The Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, these all make it harder. And they're intended to, because we don't want to.
Yeah, luckily we don't have any of that in Canada. So,
right. I always think that if the United States enacted Canada's immigration rules, it would be such a scandal. Canada, it's like you pretty much like they're much more heavily into what we would call an H-1B visa type of situation. You have to come in with skills and all that kind of stuff. Whereas the U.S. is kind of works against that, partly because the corporate powers that have influence in Washington want lots and lots and lots of cheap workers. And so they're not looking for competitors. They're looking for consumers and workers. And so, but if like, let's say President Trump suddenly enacted Canada's law to the letter, it would be the most outrageous scandal imaginable. People would be running in the streets going, "Oh my God, they're just, elitist, blah, blah, blah." Mexico too. I mean, all of our neighbors have this rational policy of saying, you know what, we could really use more doctors. And so we'll prioritize professionals in one way or another. So I just think it's kind of an interesting thing that people, your average American would assume, oh yeah, Canada's probably got a really sort of liberal policy on immigration. Nope. on refugees, yes, but not immigration.
For sure.
Canada did, though. Remember, and I know Matthew knows this, but there was it was very wide open. And when was that? The 70s. And it was a lot of people came to Canada, and it's a wonderfully diverse nation because of it.
I would say, we have had problems for sure, and I would never claim that Canada was some kind of utopian society, but nothing gets me thinking about how well things work here as a multicultural society, like going to the U.S. Right. I mean, there's just things you take for granted in a place like Toronto or Vancouver or even Ottawa, just the way culture works, different people speaking different languages, doing different things.
It's so wonderful when you go to Toronto. Toronto has two Chinatowns.
and they're both excellent.
I mean, it's just wonderful, the diversity there. And when I worked at Rogers, the staff was incredibly diverse. Partly it's because we were in the Ethnix Channel building, and they do broadcasts, newscasts for like 50 different languages. But It's really a model of what could happen, and it's a shame that it's become less open.
One of the things that I like to say to confuse and enrage Canadians is that Canada is like the United States, but the United States is nothing like Canada, by which I mean that there are many pockets of the United States that are a lot like Canada in every way, including diversity. I went to the most diverse university in the world, which is UCLA, and it was fantastic because of the diversity. There are parts of the Northeast, you know, New York is a wonderful mm-hmm. example of great diversity. So a lot of the cultural elements that you find in Canada, you'll also find in the United States. However, you won't find a Texas in Canada. You won't find a South. You won't find, you know, the problem with absolutely everything in the United States besides extremism in every direction is that the lack of evenly distributed culture, of laws, of norms, and et cetera. So it's interesting. I don't know what this has to do with Google, but but it is interesting. Yeah, Google's going to help.
We do have a Texas. It's called Alberta.
That's okay. True. Actually, there are Texases. In the,
Cowboys and guns, oil and beer.
Texas is a friend of mine. Yeah, Alberta is no Texas, I tell you.
It's like a nicer version of Texas.
When we went into, Barcelona, exactly. I was just blown away. And I guess it's probably because we were affluent white people coming from the United States. But remember that once you're in Barcelona, you can go anywhere in Europe without any customs controls. As long as you're right. any port of entry in the EU, they barely looked at us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they didn't look at our bags. They didn't look at anything. They barely looked at the passports. Like, yeah.
It's very unnerving.
That's the best part about going to Europe.
And I can go anywhere now. I'm in Europe. I'm going anywhere. So
the guy says hello. You show him your passport.
Yeah. It was almost as easy getting back in the U.S., frankly. It wasn't. In fact, you know, Johnny Jett, our travel guys, always say, you got to get global entry, Leo. You got to get global entry. Really speed it up. The line for global entry when we got off the plane and JFK was around the block. We just walked right up, showed him our passport, walked right in. Everybody's got global entry now. So the smart thing to do is not have it. That's what I think, anyway. Here is an interesting story about Burger King and their new ads created by artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. I don't think they actually were, although some people might consider ad agencies artificially intelligent.
Gender reveal, bad. Tender reveal, yum. It is a boy bird with crispy chicken tenders from Burger Thing. Like a lavender, but -1. Math is tasty. Tender plus sauce equals romantic dinner. Eat the math. Pick two of these for $6. BK logo appears.
I don't like it.
Yeah, it's excellent.
So Burger natural King. And authentic.
Burger King in a press release says the video is the work of a new deep learning algorithm, but an article from Ad Age says humans.
Yeah, it's a joke.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Have you seen there's a guy on Twitter who constantly posts, I made an artificial intelligence algorithm watch, you know, 100 episodes of Seinfeld and then it wrote one.
Yeah.
And he picks different things.
Is it?
And they're hilarious, but they're jokes. I mean, he makes them up.
Okay. So this is an Olive Garden commercial after.
Yeah. That's a really
good one. Is this after watching Seinfeld?
No, so he made it watch a whole bunch of Olive Garden commercials.
A group of friends laughs at a dinner table. Uh-oh. Just click the first one. There you go. A group of friends laughs at the dinner table. A waitress comes to deliver what could be considered food. Waitress, pasta nachos for you. We see the pasta nachos. They're warm and
they're
defeated.
Warm and defeated.
Friend one, the menu is here. Waitress, lasagna wings with extra Italy. We see the lasagna wings. There's more Italy than necessary. Friend two, I shall eat Italian citizens. Waitress, unlimited stick. We see the unlimited stick. It is infinite. It is all.
Yeah, they are warm and defeated. That's my
Friend three, leave without me. I'm home. Waitress, gluten classico from the kitchen. We see the gluten classico. We believe the waitress that it is from the kitchen. We have no reason not to believe. Friend four says nothing. Friend one, What is wrong, friend four? Friend four says nothing. Friend two, friend four, what is wrong, friend four? Friend four smiles wide. Her mouth is full of secret soup. Olive Garden. When you're here, you're here. Says the wet voiced announcer.
They're a great parody of sort of bad.
But just to be clear, he's writing these. This isn't really.
But I think what this represents, and the Burger King thing represents, is the creeping realization that things that are presented as AI are not very smart by how we consider smartness. In fact, human intelligence is quite an amazing thing that we are years and years and years from replicating in any convincing way. I mean, best example I've ever seen is that the day after Bill Cosby was handcuffed and hauled off to prison, Twitter recommended that I follow him on Twitter.
Oh, my God. I don't think he'll be tweeting a lot.
Not going to be tweeting a lot.
And I for them to realize that it come to the conclusion that I wanted to follow Bill Cosby because I mentioned him, I made some crack about Jell-O pudding or something like that, and now all of a sudden it's like you should follow him.
He's funny.
If a person recommended that, I would say you're an idiot.
Just don't take any drinks from him.
Right.
What's funny though, that article points out that it's become part of marketing that you want to pretend that artificial intelligence is involved because it makes you sound really smart or that what you're doing is really. And yet, do you remember when Facebook came out with what was it called, M or something? It was its assistant that was going to help you.
Yeah, it became racist.
And they pretended that it was AI, even though it was human beings.
This is what happened. A lot of companies are doing this, and I think this is the big lesson for AI. I'm sorry to cut you off, Matthew. There are a lot of, anytime somebody comes out with AI that has human assistance, their intention is to say, okay, when there's a mistake, when the computers can't figure something out, we have this team that will figure it out, and they will also train the algorithm so that over time we'll gradually phase out the humans. They've tried this with M, as you mentioned. There's a great AI calendar scheduling meeting app called Amy from X.AI, I believe, is the company.
Oh yeah,
and I'm pretty sure they're still using human assistants. The biggest area of this is driverless cars. What we were told was that they're developing these driverless cars, and then we'll turn them loose on the highways and they'll just flawlessly drive around. What they've come to realize, though, is that all of these actual examples of self-driving cars, like in Arizona and so on, they have a NASA-like control room of people who are monitoring everything and who can remotely take control. And because AI just cannot function like a human can, as Jeff would say, full stop. And so this idea that you're going to have control rooms of humans monitoring self-driving cars is going to be here for decades, I think. And if you look at some of the self-driving delivery systems, those are heavily monitored remotely. The little ice cooler that goes down the sidewalk, completely monitored by a control room. And so the idea that AI is anywhere near being able to just function on its own without human input is a delusion. It is not going to happen.
I would argue that this also extends to social media. I mean, if you look at the problems that Facebook in particular has had, and Twitter for that matter, trying to algorithmically or through machine learning recognize trolls or spam or harassment, there are nuances of human behavior that even some human beings aren't that great at recognizing, let alone being able to train an algorithm to do it. And that you just cannot do it at the kind of scale that Facebook is trying to do it.
One of the most frustrating things about Zuckerberg's testimony in front of the Senate hearing was that one of the only satisfying answers that he gave was that, we're on the brink of developing AI that will just handle this in real time. Right. And everybody's like, great, that's fantastic. In fact, that was the worst possible scenario. Yeah. Essentially, Facebook is saying that we kind of view AI as this rug where we can sweep under which we can sweep these things that we have to eventually apologize for. It'll all happen behind the scenes. If we are deleting false positives because our algorithm falsely thinks they're fake news, no one will ever know because it's right. instantaneous in real time. And so that really bothered me. That the AI is going to handle it is not a good answer to any of these problems.
It's the perfect answer. Because A, a lot of people go, oh, that's great. And B, if it fails, who gets the blame?
You don't know.
AI,
right?
It's a perfect answer. This guy's no fool. By the way, that Olive Garden parody is written by comedian Keaton Patti. You can follow him on Twitter at KEAATONPATTI. And I, for one, want lasagna wings with more Italy than ever before.
I think Warm and Defeated makes a nice showtime.
Warm and Defeated. Yeah. we see the pasta nachos. They're warm and defeated. Speaking of defeated, a sad day coming our way. March 2019, GeoCities will pass into internet history.
I had a GeoCities page.
Did you really?
Yep.
I'm trying to think. I don't think I ever did.
Yep.
The internet in 1990s was filled to the brim. Filled to the brim, writes CNET, with flashy text art, pixelated graphics, neon colors, and broken HTML. Those were simpler times. The best discovery in this article. Yeah, right. And then a mailbox that opens and closes. The best discovery here is the Tumblog, 1 terabyte of kilobyte age photo op.
Nice.
Sounds like a title written, frankly, by AI. But it's full of GeoCities pages.
Nice.
I don't know if can you still go to the Turkish Angora Breeders Union page? No. Nope. Who owns? It says I guess Yahoo owns GeoCities.
Yahoo Japan.
Yahoo Japan owns. Oh yeah. Wow.
Good times.
Here's one. Something's wrong with this one. Physician-assisted suicide. There is a page. That's a good-looking page. What's really good about this site is they're all rendered in 1990s-era Internet Explorer.
Nice.
Yeah.
Really authentic.
One of the most shocking things about this GeoCities news is that Yahoo bought it in 1999 for $3.6 billion.
What?
Yeah. Unheard of back then for a price like that. That's just an outrageous amount for back then. I mean, back then.
That was actually, you know, if I remember, Fred Wilson of Union Square Ventures, I think, famous VC who's invested in all sorts of startups. GeoCities was one of his first big payoffs.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He took the money and run.
A ton of money.
Where can I find stupid money like that?
It was going to be the new AOL.
With Yahoo gone, it's really harder to find that kind of...
You know, ironically, the idea behind GeoCities is actually quite forward-thinking. It's like an open thing where people can post their own... You know, it's a combination of social networking, blogging, essentially, and also, you know, building
a website.
Yeah, it
was like WordPress and Tumblr. Yeah.
If you were to hear a description of that and say that this was something that was available in the 90s, you'd think, wow, they were way ahead of their time. But now it's just viewed as the opposite of ahead of their time. And
so Yahoo
just
sort of killed that and Tumblr. That's some good work by Yahoo.
Yahoo Japan is different than the other Yahoo.
Tumblr's going to be killed?
No, not killed so much as in fact,
smothered.
I've actually been spending more time on there.
What is going on? This is owned by Verizon now, right? This is part of the Oath family of companies.
Yeah.
I wonder what Verizon has in mind for Tumblr, because Tumblr is a pretty much Wild West part of the net, right?
Yeah.
It's great software.
It is, which is part of what I like about it.
And it's wonderful software.
It's also the sort of, I know there's a lot of porn and so on, but there's also a lot of people who, you know, I don't think would fit anywhere else. There's a lot of art. There's a lot of just odd people with things they're interested in. I find that type of stuff fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it's an easy way to make a blog, and it's kind of the original concept of a blog, which is a stream of stuff.
Because my daughters started using it, and they almost exclusively consumed media in the form of animated GIFs from anime TV shows. So literally that was 98% of their media consumption at one point, which I just found fascinating.
I had a very prime Tumblr address, which I constantly got emails people wanted it, which is leo.tumblr.com.
Mm. Yeah,
but I killed it. So if somebody's been looking for that, go ahead and get it. You know what? I don't think I didn't really need to kill Tumblr. It really, but getting off Instagram, Tumblr, Twitter, and Facebook was also was part of a larger thing. Like stop looking at news, like Google News and Microsoft News and the news feed. Stop watching cable news to the degree that I can. I mean, I got to keep up on what's going on, but.
Yeah,
that all that stuff was not helping my mental state, and now I've noticed a really, and I wonder if maybe it's just people I know, but a really negative trend. It's mostly young people. I should ask these Australians before they left. I noticed it because I no longer am looking at these things. People, instead of conversation, will show you stuff from the world, like hold up memes, like you're at dinner, and they go, "Look at that," instead of conversing. Have you seen this?
I've actually done that. I mean, I do it with my daughters.
Did you see this on Instagram?
Maybe I'm too deep into it, but I actually find it. It starts conversation. It is.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it does.
I mean, and it is me trying to communicate with them in a way that they, you know, feel comfortable.
Yeah, I guess if I had younger kids, I might, but. Now, because I don't see Instagram or Facebook or anything, I kind of want to almost shield my eyes. Like, no, don't show me that.
I've been trying to do less. I mean, I have to be on Twitter for my job. I have to read the news. I have to know what's going on and what people are talking about. But I agree with you that I don't think it's fundamentally a healthy way to live all the time. And so I'm trying to scale it back to the point where I do other things outside of kind of work, or I try and put a limit on it and then go and look at funny cat videos or something.
I guess you could make the case that that's all that this network is us finding stuff to show people on the internet. Did you see this?
Well, it is in a way.
It is, right?
In a way.
I'm sorry, Mike, go ahead.
No, the world needs to be shown things. I don't think that podcasts are addictive, though. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that. The problem with social media is that it's designed and increasingly evolving to become more distracting and addictive and to gobble up more and more of your time. Yes. Whereas I think podcasts gobbles up more of your time because there's lots of information and stories and stuff like that. Anyway, I'm the biggest podcast fan in the universe.
Thank you for promoting podcasts.
But I've been doing it for, I've been the biggest podcast fan in the world for a long, long time. But one of the things that is interesting and I think is the best tip I can give people for avoiding the kinds of problems you're talking about is to not consume the feed that you get. You have to. So I have two Twitter accounts. One is for incoming and one is for outgoing. So Mike Elgin is where I connect to people that I know, that I connect to people that are interesting, that I connect for all the normal reasons you connect. But I 99% of the time, I don't look at the stream. I have another stream, which is cherry picked for news, for specific types of information that I like to get from Twitter. And it's completely devoid of rancor, of BS, of the kind of politics. I use a lot of muted words features, so I don't have to hear about the political stuff of the moment. And so I have one for input and one for output. Every once in a while, I'll look at the output for the Mike Elgin account. But I recommend that it's not being on social media. It's consuming social media as a source of information. It's good for outgoing. It's not good for incoming.
I spend a lot of time trying to come up with sort of ways of correcting that problem. So Twitter lists was one way, and I'd never actually look at my stream. I only look at lists. And so
that's interesting.
Theoretically, it kind of focuses the stream on specific topics, although, you know, Trump infects everything eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do exactly what you do, Mike, because of you, actually. I killed my outbound account completely, but I have a links for Twitter account that is just news.
Yeah. And, it's a great source of news.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. Well, I don't consider it a source of news, but I realize that the feed reader is kind of dead. RSS is kind of dead. Yeah. Twitter has kind of supplanted it. And the one thing I find Twitter very useful for is like hot breaking news. So if I hear a rumor some celebrity has passed away or there was a big earthquake or something like that, that seems to me better. The fastest way to get that information, at least get the shape of that information, if not accurate news about it.
They used to say journalism was the first rough draft of history. And I think Twitter, in a way, has taken over that.
Even rougher.
Yeah.
Even rougher.
Much rougher. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I did with my incoming account is called the New News. And I've been using it as an incoming source of news for a long time. But a few months ago, I turned it into a breaking news feed. So I now just retweet the very most breaking news. This isn't an ad. I don't care if people follow it or not. It's just something that I do impulsively because I got to, you know, I got to share certain types of information. So it's political, it's tech, stuff like that. And I just reshare it because it's so easy to do. But one of the things that I add to my feed, in addition to sources, that I add people who are super good at retweeting. And the best retweeter on the internet, I guarantee you, is Matthew Ingram.
Really?
So if you follow one person on Twitter, follow Matthew, because you retweet the best content. And and it's like if you get most people are retweeting you look at your stream and you're like, why am I getting that on my stream? And then you realize somebody I followed for tech is retweeting sports ball. And I'm like, oh my God, sport. I don't want that in my, but yeah, Matthew Ingram is like the guy to follow. Thanks, because you just have, and this goes back to what a newspaper is. You have intelligent journalists who are curating sources of information and information itself for you. And that's really what everybody should be looking for on social.
That is like the old days of Twitter, 5-6 years ago, where there were people.
I miss those days.
Yeah, who was the guy? It was great. He became the Twitter journalist. He used it exclusively.
Andy Carvin.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was great. You could follow Andy, and you knew that you
he
were
going to. He was a genius.
Yeah. Is he still?
Yeah, he's still. So he's teaching actually at UBC.
He made that his full-time job at one point, right?
He did, yeah. He was at NPR originally, right. I think. And then, he started Reportedly, which was effectively a journalistic enterprise devoted to just doing that. And it was brilliant. And then the Omid Yar Network stopped funding it. Uh-huh. And then he moved to this. His work was seminal in terms of using social media properly for journalism and turning. I interviewed him a number of times about it. And he said he looked at it as Twitter was effectively his newsroom. He did crowdsourcing journalism that was just unparalleled.
He was the guy to read during the Arab Spring.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another brilliant example is Nick Bilton for his wonderful book, Hatching Twitter. He has all these very sort of storytelling approaches to things. Oh, it was a beautiful sunny day in Sunnyvale in 2000, right. October, whatever, right. 2006. And he got all that information by going back in Twitter and seeing what people are posting. Mm-hmm. He got little details about what people were wearing and what kind of muffin they got at Starbucks and like all this kind of detail. Because people post that kind of stuff, and he was able to go back and use it as a sort of historic snapshot of what individual specific people were saying and doing and thinking and feeling and et cetera. And so as a journalistic storytelling research, if you're telling history, it's wonderful because, of course, you can search and find all those details.
Speaking of retweeting, I actually remember, believe it or not, in the early days, remember when retweeting was like brand new and people would type the letters RT or the...
Yeah, there was no MT facility to do it. Yeah.
Manual tweet.
Yeah.
I had a friend who got really, really mad at me for retweeting. He was like, why are you doing that? You should be posting your own thoughts. You shouldn't just be retweeting other people. And I was like, sure, I have my own thoughts.
That's one point of view.
People say smart things, and I want to cheer them on. He just was outraged that this was not how you should be using Twitter.
It's really a shame. Those of us who've been with Twitter for a long time to have watched its rise and fall. I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking back every time I see a hashtag, and you see them all. I mean, Google's event coming up on Tuesday is hashtag made by Google. I think about Chris Messina, who invented it. And it was just kind of, you know, I know Chris, he's just kind of a nice guy. And he just said, it'd be kind of cool if you put a hashtag in front of something and be like a
cancer. And of course, he got that from IRC, I think.
Did he?
Hmm.
Yep. Yep. Right. Hashtags were already in use.
They were already in use. Okay.
He just used the idea.
Well, and then Twitter was smart because they took these ideas that were really homegrown and they incorporated them into the system.
The at mention.
Of that.
I love how Instagram lets you follow a hashtag and it shuffles it into your stream.
That's new, and I do like that feature.
It is kind of, in a way, Twitter is like a live sort of research lab into the kind of downsides and upsides of just mass kind of real-time communication, social communication. Yeah. It's like a conversation with millions of people, all of whom have different kind of competing agendas, some of whom are mentally disturbed. And I mean,
You're talking about Kanye West now, right?
Yeah, Kanye.
He's pretty good at getting attention for himself on Twitter as well.
I think a little bit.
Yeah, I think Twitter is like a narcissist's dream, and I think that narcissists make the best trolls.
Well, Trump is the whole point. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I think that to me personally, I like Twitter a lot. I I've been harping on this for years and years, especially on this show. They just need to make one change. Let me delete other people's comments to my tweet. And then I can start conversations and I can moderate those conversations. And then beyond that, I don't need any other censorship or filtering or anything. Just let me start conversations and then let them not be hijacked by people who are out to disrupt conversations. And that's it. That's all they have to do. And it would be fantastic.
It is pretty unprecedented that you can be sort of having a conversation with people and some rando can just, you know, from across the world can kind of jump into your conversation and torpedo the whole thing.
Well, what happens is like I'm harping away at the president all the time sometimes you hit a nerve, you put on some list and so it's distributed to all the trolls and then they all come after you. And it's just, you know, my comments for my at mentions, looking at, you know, people that are at mentioning me, just becomes unusable for like a month because it's just flooded with Russian bots and all this garbage. Yeah. And I just would love some control over that. And I really don't need any additional filtering beyond that. I think Twitter's fine the way it is, except for that.
Well, here's our last story. It's a very good news. Twitter has finally allowed you to opt out of curated timelines and go back to the chronological tweet.
Yep.
They phased them out 2 years ago. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Go into the settings, and I don't know, have you guys done it yet? I don't know.
I did, actually, and this might seem like heresy.
You like the curated?
So I've been trying to spend less time on Twitter, and I actually find the when I come back,
stuff you might have missed.
The stuff you missed is actually helpful.
Yeah.
I don't care about stuff I miss. Honestly.
I would like to miss more stuff.
I would like to miss more stuff.
I'm worried about missing things.
It bugs the hell out of me when I see a 2-day-old tweet at the top of my...
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Me too.
I don't know. I'm of two minds about it. Like I said, if I was on it all the time like I used to be, then I would have definitely much more preferred the chronological. But I do find it useful to get kind of... I'm actually looking at Twitter Discover or whatever it's called now, which I never used to do because it used to be filled with garbage. But just to try and find out, you know, is there a Twitter moment about something that's going on that's interesting? Is there a conversation going on somewhere that I should know about? Because I am trying to dip in and out more often instead of just having it on all the time.
The thing that continually comes up for me when we talk about Twitter is why do we let this company take something that is really potentially of a lot of value? Why do we let them be in charge of this? Why don't all the journalists, all the people who are good and interesting on Twitter, why don't why don't they do something different? Why don't they go somewhere? Why doesn't somebody create something? Because Twitter is the worst possible steward of this thing that is valuable.
But people have created things and no one goes there.
No, I used Mastodon
I've tried every
briefly.
Single one.
I know.
Yeah, Mastodon. What's the other one? App.net.
That's gone.
You know, that was going to be paid for. And Mastodon is great, but there's nobody there.
That's the problem. Yeah. And that's why everybody who does good content on Twitter should move to Mastodon, and then we could finally leave this hellhole behind.
We just need to convince people to do it somehow.
Yeah, people are sheep.
Leo, I tried to get everybody to go to Google Plus, and nobody listened.
I remember that.
I went. I was there. Network effects are the most powerful human phenomenon imaginable. Like, Twitter should have failed so many times because its infrastructure was terrible. The company management was ridiculous. It's one of the probably worst managed companies in history. And yet it became this massive. Yeah. It became this massive success because it was so, compelling to use and addicting, and people just couldn't help themselves. No matter how, remember how people used to complain, "Damn, this network goes down all the time," and they would complain on Twitter about how painful it was to use Twitter, and then they would just come back and keep doing it. They could not fail. They tried so many times to fail, and they failed to fail.
Yep. Facebook too, though. I mean, Facebook, how many times have they apologized for this, that, and the other thing? And the list of failed ideas that they came out with, mostly copying other companies just blatantly. Some of the things that they copied from Snapchat and other places have actually succeeded for them. But for the most part, it's been one failure after another. But those network effects, everybody's on Facebook. So that's why you go to Facebook. It's not because Facebook is such a great company.
No, they're terrible stewards, again. But it's like
and
a
actually,
cockroach.
I know my youngest daughter, deleted her account on Facebook, and then eventually she was forced to sign up again because everyone was there, all her family members, all her extended family. There was no way to know what was going on or to see the photos of the baby or the wedding or whatever. So she was basically sucked back into it in the same way we all have to use email, even though we don't like it.
Yep.
By the way, we were talking on Sunday about Google's 20th anniversary and what did we use before Google, and there was a lot of speculation. Thanks to Jessica Condit, we now know three dead search engines, remembering Dogpile, Ask Jeeves, and AltaVista. We all agreed.
AltaVista.
She forgot a few.
Ask Jeeves was actually pretty good.
She wasn't even born, practically. But what about Excite, right? There were a few others.
Yeah,
but this is the factoid, or fact, actually, I loved from her article. The first use of the word Google as a transitive verb on American television was in 2002, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Oh. And, of course, Jessica would know this. Fourth episode of the seventh and final season. Jessica's going to be on Twit on Sunday, right?
That's fascinating.
Buffy, Willow, Xander, and the gang. Sounds like one of Brett Kavanaugh's parties. Buffy, Willow, Xander, and the gang are trying to help Cassie, a high school student, who's cryptically saying she's going to die next week in Buffy's dining room. They search through hard copies of Cassie's medical records and find nothing noteworthy. Willow tapping away on a thick white iBook turns to Buffy and says, "iBook, have you Googled her yet?" Xander replies jokingly, "Willow, she's 17.
That's amazing.
You know, to another example of the power of Google emerged today or recently. We've all heard about the New York Times expose on the Trump empire and Fred Trump and the family and the real estate deals. Donald Trump was a millionaire by age 8. He was making $200,000 a year by the time he was 3. All this kind of stuff. That entire investigative report began with a Google search.
What?
And they talked about the Google search in the article or in one of the follow-up articles where there was this, they had this odd phrase that Fred Trump, Donald Trump's father, used for recycling money back to the kids or something like that. It's called, something mortgage. It was like a preemptive mortgage or I don't know, some weird phrase that is not used by anybody else. And they simply searched Google for that phrase and the word Trump. And they found some documents and they're like, wait a minute, this document appears, and they started pulling that thread, and this entire expose came from that thread pulling.
Well, there you go. All the world's information at your fingertips.
Yep.
Let's take a break. Your picks of the week, Mike Elgin. This has been a great show. We're going to fire Jeff and Stacy.
Yeah, just fire them.
You guys. Elgin.com and becomingnomad.net. Matthew Ingram with one T. He's on the Twitter at Matthew I, M-A-T-H-E-W-I, chief digital writer at the Columbia Journalism Review. And our show today brought to you by my home on the internet, WordPress. Do you use WordPress? You ought to use WordPress. I've used WordPress practically since Matt Mullenweg invented it. For a long time, I hosted it myself until I realized, wait a minute, what am I doing spending money for a server and spending a lot of time running it when I could just have WordPress do the work? That's when I went and moved leolaporte.com to WordPress.com. And man, am I glad. It's hassle-free. WordPress takes care of the hosting, the security, the software updates. You focus on your content. And, you know, I also admit that for a while I went through a kind of a winter of blogging winter, nuclear winter, as I started using Twitter and Facebook. But now that I'm back, it feels so good to post my content on my site where it belongs. You know, I posted some stuff from the trip and I got 102 followers from WordPress. See, WordPress.com has its own follow system. I love that. And WordPress.com, you can choose from hundreds of designs to match your brand or your vision. It's great for a personal blog, but it's really good for a business blog too. You really ought to have a website for your business. That Facebook page isn't owned by you. It's owned by a guy named Zuckerberg. That Twitter page isn't owned by you. I don't know who it's owned by, but it ain't you. And you can't control it, right? But you can control your website. The Akismet anti-spam engine for comments is the best ever. I love the way comments work on WordPress, and I use them all the time. I just think it's fantastic. Upload the images right to your site so you're hosting them, audio and video as well. Not on YouTube, not somewhere else where it could be taken down or dinged. Import and export content to and from your site. Nothing's ever trapped there. It's your site, your home, your content. WordPress knows that. They support it. Great tools for search engine optimization, social media linking, so your followers, your readers can share your site with their Twitter feed and their Facebook. Great marketing tools, too. And I love the WordPress app. I used that to post all through my vacation on my phone and on my tablet. It was great. You get great support, too, 24/7, even with the $4 a month plan. Yep, that's right. WordPress plan started $4 a month. When you add it all up, it's no surprise. 31% of all the websites in the world, 31% run on WordPress. But don't do it yourself. Go to WordPress.com. 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/twig. Create your website. WordPress.com/twig. I just added a news feed because I realized now that I don't use Twitter, I don't have a way of putting stories that we're going to cover on the shows on my Twitter feed. So I've now put them on my blog on a side, just an RSS feed. It makes it so easy to do that. It took me 3 seconds. WordPress.com/twig. Time for picks. I'm going to start because Lisa and I watched a great documentary.
Won't You Be My Neighbor?
Last night called Won't You Be My Neighbor. Have you guys seen this yet?
No, yeah. I want to.
Oh, my God. I was bawling my eyes out. It's now available on iTunes. You can, it's a rental or you can buy it. I bought it for $10 because I want to own this. I want to show this to anybody. It is the most moving story of Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, who created a kid's show in the 50s that everybody, or actually I guess it was the 60s, thought was, you know, kind of boring. And they interview one producer who said, everything you know about good TV, Mr. Rogers did the opposite. It was slow. It was poor. You know, the sets were bad. And it was brilliant because he spoke to children as equals. And he changed the world. And we need a little bit more of Mr. Rogers in the world. So if you haven't seen this, I know you've seen the show, Mr. Rogers, but there is a great documentary called Won't You Be My Neighbor? And I just can't recommend it more highly. It was It's beautiful. It's really, I was in tears the whole time.
In addition to what he achieved for children, I mean, he entered into the public sphere with his children's show mm-hmm. during the Vietnam War, where kids were mm-hmm. watching the war on TV. He was aware of this. A lot of social strife and so on, and he tried to do something about it. And but in addition to all that good work that he did, it's also so gratifying to see a media visionary create his mm-hmm. entirely a new world from scratch by himself. Well, not by himself entirely, but like he invented a language for how to talk to children. He demystified things like superstition. For example, the king of the land of make-believe was Friday the 13th. And every time they had a show that was actually Friday the 13th, it was the king's birthday. And he was deliberately trying to demystify the superstition around Friday the 13th. Little stuff like that. Pretty unbelievable.
He was a huge champion, obviously, of public television, too. I mean, he gave famous speech about the value of public television.
It's in the movie, and it's an incredible moment. And they got it all in the documentary. It's incredible. And they address all of this stuff. Vietnam. He did a show about death. He did a whole week about death.
Race.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
There was a big nationwide scandal at some point where black people were being banned from swimming pools and stuff like
that. Right.
So I think he had a black mailman on the show character. Yeah.
The cop.
And they sat, and what they did was they had a little foot bath.
Kids swimming pool.
And he was using it to soak his feet. And he invited the mailman to soak his feet, and they soaked their feet together. Like little things like that.
Yeah.
Not overtly political, mm-hmm. But just, you know, just bringing a level of humanitarianism.
He was a genius.
That scene is also they talk to the actor who played the cop about it, and they show that scene. It is one of the best documentaries I've seen in a long time, and I love documentaries. Won't You Be My Neighbor? And it's on iTunes now. I'm sure that means it's also on Google Play. And
and the Tom Hanks movie is coming out.
That's right.
At some point.
Tom Hanks plays Mr. Rogers.
Yes, Mr. Rogers. Yeah.
Wow.
The first photo from the set came out, and there he is in the red sweater and the sneakers and all that stuff.
You know, there's a perfect guy to play Mr. Rogers.
Yeah,
definitely.
Mike, what's your pick this week?
Nothing as consequential or important as that, for sure, but something that's kind of nice for everybody. It's a website called Light Apps List, and it's exactly what it sounds like. Somebody is curating all the light versions of apps that use less battery, less storage, less memory, for those of us who want to like lighten the load, the collective load of what's happening on our smartphones. So far, all of the apps, there's a brand new site. Everything is for Android. They're going to introduce iPhone versions as well. And they're inviting, they're crowdsourcing it and stuff like that, and going to be adding things to it. But I love the idea. So there are light versions of Twitter, light versions of Instagram, of Google Maps, of Google Go, of Gmail, all these like things that people might have heard about or maybe haven't heard about, but you can, by replacing the full featured apps with light versions of those apps, you can like, you know, radically extend your battery life. Probably the biggest benefit. So check it out, lightappslist.com, and it'll click you right to the Play Store to download.
And light is spelled LITE.
Yes.
Lightappslist.com. Matthew, you got a pick or something you're interested in?
Yeah, this was actually on the rundown, but we didn't get to it. So
good.
This is something I'm interested in. Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who you might have heard of.
Oh, yeah. We talked about this on Twitter. I want you to explain what this is all about.
I
didn't understand a word.
I wish I could. So what it sounds like to me is Sir Tim wants to effectively re-decentralize the web. So I think for some time he's been concerned about kind of centralization around platforms like Facebook and even Google for that matter. And I think, so he's started something called Solid. And Solid is effectively a protocol or a way of constructing apps that will function in a kind of distributed and decentralized way. That's the closest I can get to understanding it. And he wrote something, ironically, in a way, on Medium about it, because Medium is a bit of a walled garden. But But the idea is to try and, in his words, capture kind of what the web could have been, something that where users have a lot more control and there's a lot more sort of back and forth and interaction and interoperability and control over data, things that we've kind of been prevented from having in a way because of the way the web has developed. Now, I have to say I looked a little bit at Solid. I installed a sort of, I signed up for an iteration of it. I looked at some of the apps that are available. There's like a Notepad sort of thing. It's very, very early. It's like looking at, you know, a web browser in 1994 or whatever. So it's, but it's, the philosophy is fascinating. And certainly if anybody can kind of push this idea forward, it's Tim.
Tim has a company called Inrupt, Inrupt.com. Solid is open source. Inrupt is a company designed to somehow use Solid. It isn't all clear. He's taken a leave from the World Wide Web Consortium to do this. So I think he's pretty darn serious about it. And I've been reading up on Solid, and you know, you can make Solid apps. If you're familiar with HTML and JavaScript, typically React, Angular, or jQuery, Vue as well. So there is some, you know, I want to see people make some apps.
Yeah.
There aren't many yet.
I mean, it's still pretty early.
Yeah.
But the idea is, you know, gives more power to individual users.
Right.
And sort of more power to distributed iterations of things, as opposed to centralizing everything behind one company.
Maybe this is the solution to that network effect problem. If you get enough people to use Solid, then you could create apps that take advantage of that without invading people's privacy. You could have a Solid-based Facebook or Twitter, and you would actually have the network effect immediately. I don't know. It's a really great idea, and I wish him success. But I don't know if I really get it.
I think it's going to take a while to see, you know, what it's actually capable of.
Matthew Ingram, we love reading your stuff, and I was just giving you a hard time about the podcast bubble bursting, because you know what? You were absolutely, everything you wrote in that article was absolutely right on and accurate.
Thanks.
Yeah. Follow Matthew. In fact, you taught me a thing or two. Follow Matthew at cjr.org, where he's chief digital writer, or on the Twitter at Matthew I, MatthewI. Thank you, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
You'll find Mike Elgin at his page, elgin.com, and find out more about his amazing travel adventures. Mike and Amira do some amazing stuff.
Gastronomad.net, join us abroad. We're doing Italy, France, Morocco, Mexico City, and Barcelona. And you can come and drink with Mike all week.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Gastronomad.net.
God, I can't wait to do this.
Yeah,
Mexico City's coming up. You've sold out the Prosecco experience coming up in a couple of weeks, but Mexico City's Morocco. That might be the one I want to do. We had one day in Tangier and we're blown away. I would really like to go back. So,
yep,
good.
And we're going to be on a camel just like you were, except we're going to actually enter into the Sahara Desert.
What? Yep. Yeah, we did the tourist camel. You just go in a circle. That was more than enough, by the way. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Matthew. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern. That's 20:30 UTC. If you want to come by, say hi. We'd love to see you. You can also watch the live stream. If you want to be like those Australian kids, just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. We got 47. We now know. You can also watch live from the convenience of your home at twit.tv/live. If you do that, join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. And, of course, you can always subscribe. Your favorite podcatcher will have a copy, or go to twit.tv/twig for more information. Are Jeff and Stacy back? No, I think next week they're gone again. So we will.
What?
Yes. Hard to believe. That pretty soon we're going to forget that they even existed. This was a lot. I have to say, this is a great conversation, so thank you.
The only record will be Twitter.
We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.